cloudy, off and on, rain throughout the day. Tomorrow's high 53. Right now it's a little breezy, wind southeast at 14, gusty to 21, 49 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I suspect that many of you have at least some awareness, as I did, of one of the most horrific chapters of the Second World War, the brutal siege of the city of Leningrad by Nazi Germany, and the untold number of Russians who perished during those terrible months. An untold story within that huge tragedy is told in a remarkable new book called The Forbidden Garden, The Botanists of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice. We are talking about a place in the heart of Leningrad that housed the world's largest collection of seeds that had been collected over the course of more than two decades. And this is the story of the remarkable staff members and scientists who guarded that treasure trove of seeds and guarded it through the course of the siege of Leningrad. To some extent, huge human cost. Many of them perished of starvation, dying amidst food, as one writer termed it. And the story of their valor, the story of this decision, and the importance of this preservation is told in Simon Parkin's remarkable book published by Scribner. You may know his name from several other fascinating books that he has already written, including The Island of Extraordinary Captives, A Painter, A Poet, An Heiress, and A Spy in a World War II British Internment Camp, as well as A Game of Birds and Wolves, The Ingenious Young Women Whose Secret Board Game Helped Win World War II, and finally Death by Video Game, Danger, Pleasure, and Obsession on the Virtual Front Line. He has written extensively for The New Yorker, The Observer, The Guardian, The New York Times, the BBC, and for many other outlets as well. An award-winning journalist. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak with Simon Parkin about his newest book, The Forbidden Garden. Simon Parkin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's an extraordinary book, and I applaud you for, first of all, doing such an amazing job of describing the harrowing experience of those in Leningrad who were victims of this siege. And I also applaud you for uncovering this remarkable story so utterly unknown to most of us. Tell us how you came to know about this remarkable collection of seeds and their preservation during the siege of Leningrad. How did you first become even aware of the basic kernel of this story?
Well, yes, it was exactly that, the basic kernel of the story, that I found when I was reading a newspaper article about a land dispute in the suburbs of St. Petersburg, which is what the city of Leningrad is now called. And property developers wanted to build some flats and apartments on this land in Pavlovsk, which is a few dozen miles outside of St. Petersburg. And there was outcry from botanists, not only in Russia, but across the world, because this land was owned by the Plant Institute, the world's first seed bank in the middle of the city. And it just so happened to have a high density of rare trees and plants that had been put there by botanists in the 1920s and 1930s. And so there was a resistance to building these apartments. And the newspaper story just had a couple of throwaway lines about the Second World War and the fact that the botanists who worked at the seed bank had protected the collection with their lives. And that was enough to sort of gain my attention and send me off down the rabbit hole, trying to find out everything I could about the story, to see what else had been written about it and where I might be able to build on that history.
I am so interested to learn a little more about how you went about doing that, because you tell this story in extraordinary detail. What sort of written legacy has been left behind that allowed you to tell this story so thoroughly?
Well, it was a long process. I was helped greatly by the fact that the seed bank is still there in St. Petersburg, in the same building where the collection was housed in the 1940s, and in many of the same rooms where some of the botanists perished from starvation, and their descendants and colleagues today work in those rooms. And so I wrote to the seed bank and received a reply from the archivist who works there, who spoke English and was willing and able to help me and to scan and photograph documents held in the archive there and send them across to me where I could have them translated and start to build the story where I could. There were some survivors of the siege of Leningrad in the Plant Institute, and they, in some cases, had written down their memories of that time and what they had gone through. There was a book published in Russia in the 1960s to which some of the botanists contributed their memories, so I was able to get hold of that. And in the late 70s, a Russian journalist had written a short book about what had happened to them, for which he had interviewed some of the survivors. So it was a case of putting together all of these various sources and really trying to get as much day-to-day detail as I could, because I think the general outline of the story is known among botanists, certainly not among most people, but among people who work as seed bankers know the general outline. But there was not really an account that gave a week-by-week telling of what it was like to live in a city where food supplies are dwindling and then completely run out, and being faced with this terrible decision of whether to eat the seeds around you that have got tremendous scientific value, or whether to preserve them so that when the siege breaks, they could plant the fields and start again.
We're speaking with Simon Parkin about his newest book, The Forbidden Garden, The Botanist of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice. Let's take a couple minutes to learn about the creation of what ultimately became the Plant Institute, the world's first archive of seeds of this particular nature. Tell us what you think is most important for us to know about when and where and under what circumstances this collection was first created.
The seed bank was started by an explorer and botanist called Nikolai Vavilov. He was actually very well known at the time in the 1920s and 30s, partly because he spent so much time traveling the world and meeting people, meeting farmers and scientists, collaborating with scientific institutions. And he came up with this plan to visit five of the major continents and there collect as many wild varieties of seed and plant as he could and bring them back to Leningrad. He was motivated by the idea that some of these wild varieties of wheat and flax and barley and oats might have genetic properties that had been overlooked by farmers hundreds of years earlier when they were selecting their seeds. And perhaps by studying them and experimenting with them and ultimately crossbreeding them with contemporary varieties, he might be able to create what we would now describe as super crops that had a much higher yield and could essentially stave off the waves of famine that had been affecting the Soviet Union for so many years. And he and his young team of botanists traveled around collecting these seeds and samples and bringing them back to Leningrad, to this building, which is right in the center of the city on St. Isaac's Square, near the cathedral, near the famous Hermitage Museum. Quite an unlikely place, you might think, for a quarter of a million seeds and plants, but there it was, a former Tsarist palace that they were based in. And throughout the 1930s, Vavilov clashes with Stalin and his regime and finds himself at the tough end of Stalin's viewpoints, and Stalin is suspicious of Vavilov's international collaboration and various other things. And it's in the August of 1940, Vavilov is out collecting wheat samples on a mountainside near Ukraine, and a black car pulls up and four shady-looking men get out of the car and say, "Vavilov, you're needed with us on urgent business in Moscow." And he gets into the car, and of course it was actually a trap, and the four men were members of the NKVD, the precursor to the KGB, and they took him to Moscow, where he was placed under grueling interrogations and ultimately sentenced to death. So at the beginning of the siege of Leningrad, which starts in the late summer of 1941, the botanists at the seed bank in the city are left leaderless and not really sure of what they should be doing as the German army begins to advance.
As you talk about Vavilov and the opposition which he began to face in terms of his work and the attitudes of people like, for instance, the country's leader, Joseph Stalin, at the time, you bring up the term cultural revolution. And the fact that Stalin's attacks on Vavilov were part of something much larger that was afoot at the time.
Yes, but Vavilov was seen as a member of, I suppose, what would be termed now the intellectual elite. He was from a well-to-do family, and even though he was first and foremost a scientist who was only interested in science, he wasn't a politician. He didn't really play political games. He was just interested in the work that he had dedicated his life to. He was nevertheless caught up in the politics of the era, and there were various rival and perhaps cannier botanists working at the same time, principal among them Trofim Lysenko, who was promoted above Vavilov. And Lysenko had different theories, but that resonated more closely with communist ideals. And so that's part of the reason that Vavilov was sidelined and ultimately murdered by the state.
We fast forward to the middle of 1941. And one of the things you tell us in the book is that Russia's leaders had received a number of warnings that their alliance with Nazi Germany was going to be, in a sense, disrupted. I mean, and that that Germany would soon be invading Russia, and it's an intriguing picture that you paint of seemingly the Russian government refusing to either fully believe this, or to grasp the significance, or to understand the importance of trying to prepare for such a thing. And it sounds like then ultimately when Germany did strike out at Russia, it did so in a way that, in at least to some extent, caught them utterly by surprise. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think Stalin and the Soviet government did believe that their shaky alliance with Nazi Germany would at some point break. The two countries were obviously had opposing ideologies, but thought that it would hold for far longer than it did. And as you say, Stalin received dozens and dozens of warnings from spies and from diplomats and other people saying that Germany was preparing to invade the Soviet Union. And rather than listen to or act on those tip-offs, in fact, Stalin punished some of those who brought him this information, presumably because he just didn't want to hear it. And so this means that when, in the summer of 1941, German troops invade the Soviet Union, the country is completely unprepared, and they make very fast work of crossing this vast expanse. They are held up to a certain degree by the weather, by mud, by roads that they were expecting to be in better shape than they actually were. But nonetheless, they reach the outskirts of Leningrad by the late summer. So you can just get a sense of how fast their advance was because of the unpreparedness of the Soviet Union and the Red Army.
By the way, before the siege actually takes hold, I mean, on the eve of that, in an intriguing chapter titled Unwanted Treasure, I think you make such an interesting observation about what it felt like for these scientists to be doing this particular work at a time of such danger and turbulence. You describe a scene in which Ivanov, who by now is one of the leaders of this plant institute, you say, as he climbed the majestic staircase that fed a rabbit warren of shadowy corridors, the botanist felt reassured. Inside the institute, time appeared to flow differently. This was a place of profound stillness. Something of the essence of life had been captured and stored in these rooms. Genetic material that had outlasted generations of shape-shifting human conflict, cycles of politicians, successions of czars, recurring battles for territory and resources. There was a reassuring continuity to the collection, a connection to the genetic fabric of the natural world, which predated the arrival of humankind, and which might yet outlast the species' violent squabbles and vanities. I just love that. I am curious, though, is that a supposition of yours, or do we have any sort of tangible evidence that those working in the Plant Institute indeed saw their work with that sort of overarching perspective?
Well, I think the reason that I feel confident writing that paragraph is in the fact that they choose not to eat the collection of seeds ultimately, and to protect it because they have this long view that goes above and beyond their immediate circumstances and even their own lives. You would not be able to take that drastic choice unless you had some kind of sense that the work that you were doing played into a larger story than yourselves. And I think as well, Vavilov had pushed upon his staff members and his friends that the work they were doing was important, that some of these seeds could be lost by conflict, by war, by the expansion of cities or whatever it might be. All of the things that we today recognize do threaten the natural world and threaten plants and animals and other aspects of the natural world. And I think he did have an understanding about that, and that lent their mission a certain urgency.
Very much so. Explain why Leningrad was the initial target of Nazis rather than Moscow. That you describe some very intriguing reasons why Adolf Hitler wanted Leningrad to fall first.
Yes, I mean, this did come from the top. So this was a direct order from Hitler that the German troops were not to advance on Moscow until Leningrad had fallen. Certainly initially in the early weeks and months of the conflict. And the reasons for this were predominantly symbolic. So Leningrad was the birthplace of Bolshevism and revolution, and the idea that the city would fall would strike a blow, really, at Nazism's ideological opponents. And so I think this is partly why it was so important to Hitler to take down this symbol and, in a sense, undermine the regime, Stalin's regime, and the communist project very early on, before then advancing on the new capital.
One of the most fascinating passages in the book is when you compare the preparations being done by those at the Hermitage Museum, this extraordinary collection of artworks, and the way in which the city government of Leningrad was moving with great speed and determination to try and preserve its greatest treasures. And then here is its neighbor, the Plant Institute, seemingly ignored for quite a long time. The city government of Leningrad showing no interest, scarcely even an awareness of the importance of what was housed at the Plant Institute and the importance of somehow preserving it. Explain what the staff there did, in a sense, in the sort of political vacuum, in the lack of interest from Leningrad city government. What did they do to try to ensure that this important work and this priceless collection would be preserved?
Well, as you say, across St. Isaac Square at the Hermitage, the botanists could see the example of the curators there and how they had taken this very active, enlightened lead. And this was partly because of the museum's director, Joseph Orbeli, who had made preparations even before the invasion to build boxes and other things that could be used to evacuate the Hermitage treasures very quickly in the event of an invasion. And that's precisely what the Hermitage staff do, even before they receive any direct orders from the Soviet government as to what to do. So Ivanov, who is by this point running the Plant Institute, is a friend of Orbeli, the director of the Hermitage, and so he's aware of what they're doing across there with the artistic treasures. And I think there is a sort of eagerness or that grows into desperation of why aren't the plants and the seeds being treated in the same way? Why aren't we receiving any assistance from the army to get these seeds boxed up and taken out of Leningrad before the enemy arrives? It's really an 11th hour order that comes in just as the Germans are arriving in the suburbs of the city, that the Plant Institute is told, okay, you can have two carriages on a train, and they're sharing the space with many other institutes in the city, and they're told to box up the most important seeds and that they will be evacuated along with some of the staff. This does happen, and the train is loaded up, and the staff pack extra seeds in their luggage and go and get on the train. But it's too late. The train is held up before it can get through Magar Station, which is the only route out of the city by that point. And the town of Magar falls just before the train makes it through. So rather tragically, the train has to forlornly make its way back to the city. And in fact, the portion of the collection that was boxed up then remains on sidings for 6 months, sort of being shunted back and forth while the city is bombed. So none of the seeds and plants make it out before the siege begins.
Mm-hmm. When the siege, in fact, then does begin, the staff undertakes all kinds of procedures and protocols to do what they could to protect this storehouse. One thing that I did not quite understand, this is in the chapter called City of Fire. You write at one point, staff could only enter the seed rooms once a week and only in groups of three or four while accompanied by the on-duty overseer. Explain what this was about, why these kind of strict measures were taken. What was the point of that?
Well, there's a couple of reasons as I understand it. Firstly, there's just a sense of accountability. So they pack the seeds onto the first floor, as in off the ground floor, so one story up in the building. That's partly to make it harder for any looters or break-ins to locate the seed collection. So they bundle them up, put them in these two rooms, and then keep the doors locked, and they have quite a strict schedule whereby they can go and check the seeds. And as you say there, they have to do it accompanied by one another. I think it's really to perhaps ensure that no one tries to take any to eat them. It's just having the sense of shared responsibility and purpose of, no, we're deciding to protect the seeds here. We're not going to take any to distribute to our families that back home who might be have run out of food. Their cupboards may have run empty by now. So that's the first reason. And the second being that as the first terrible winter of the siege draws in and food has mostly gone from the city, families are being faced with this terrible decision to eat their pets, and they sometimes trade their pets with those of their neighbors to make that easier. And most of the city's cats and dogs are killed as a result. This results in a surge of vermin, and so the seed bank is assaulted by rats and mice who presumably can sense the seeds in there. And so by having them locked in these rooms, and they also put sheets of tin that they've taken off the institute roof over the top of the 120,000 seed tins, they are also trying to hold back this invasion of rodents as well, from who are also trying to eat the collection.
Right. And as you tell us, as Leningrad loses nearly all of its, for instance, household pets and service animals and so on, the rats no longer have competition and become far more bold and aggressive. And it's one of the most fascinating passages in the book, in which you talk about the staff's relentless efforts to rid the Plant Institute of these vermin. You also describe what the staff members of the Plant Institute are called upon to do when Nazi bombs begin raining down on the city of Leningrad, and on those occasions when an incendiary bomb would land on the Institute itself. Describe what these scientists and staff members would need to do in this situation, and again and again and again.
Yes, well, there were a total of 108 incendiaries landed specifically on the seed bank roof, which gives you a good sense of how many bombs were being dropped by German planes. The Institute had a rota, so I think there were four on-duty staff members at any one time, and as soon as a firebomb landed on the roof, one or two of them would have to run up and grab the smoking cylinder with pincers. They would then fling it down into the courtyard below, where then other staff members were stationed with piles of sand that they could shovel on top of the incendiary. And that would put it out. And the seed bank staff kept very meticulous records of every time a bomb landed on the roof. So, you know, this was in the relative early stage of the siege, before they were actively starving to death. And so they were able to keep these records and still had enough physical strength to be able to combat these bombs.
By the way, at one point you describe how women began playing a particularly important role during the siege of Leningrad, in many cases, in many different places, serving as guards, including at the Plant Institute, where there were several women who, for a time, were, in a sense, the primary guards of the cellar where some of the treasures were kept. This is a fascinating bit of the story in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a natural outcome of the fact that so many young men or men of fighting age were called to the front lines. And so Leningrad, to a certain degree, was a city predominantly of women, and the women were involved in every aspect of life in the city, from defense to trying to find ways to feed people as well. And as you say, that was also true at the Plant Institute, where the on-duty manager was a young woman. I mean, Vavilov had his teams were, you know, not predominantly men or women. He had an equal gender split among the young botanists. He was, you know, more interested in people's scientific capabilities, I think, than anything else. And so it was already quite a rich mix of people who worked there. And so that was just naturally reflected on the duties that they were called to carry out during the months of the siege.
In the chapter called The Road of Grace, you describe how Lake Ladoga, when it iced over, became, in a sense, an ice road, which finally allowed for certain evacuations to take place, including a portion of the staff at the Plant Institute. And those who remained, and they were a small number, I think, of maybe 14, received then a telegram that was significant, a telegram which had the words, "Spare nothing to support people." Explain who this telegram came from and its message and how the staff responded.
So the telegram came from the acting director of the seed bank, who by this point had flown out of the city. In fact, he flew out fairly early on. He was, as far as I know from my research, a supporter of Lysenko, so he was essentially on the other side to Vavilov and many of his staff, and fled the city in the early weeks. So leaving Ivanov and the other more junior members of staff to workers, sort of looking after themselves and figuring out what they were going to do. His telegram arrives essentially justifying the eating of the collection, giving them permission that if this is what you need to do to survive, then don't hold back. And of course, as you can imagine, this causes a certain amount of debate among the botanists who are there, who by this point are starting to starve to death. The first botanists die of starvation in November of 1941, so relatively soon after the siege begins, and the first winter hits them extremely hard. So yes, they then have this, you know, very intense decision to make. They have the permission of the acting director to eat the seeds, and yet they decide to stay resolute for whatever reason. I think perhaps to honor the memory of their colleagues who have lost their lives protecting the collection, to eat the collection at this point would have been a betrayal of that sacrifice. Also, I think because the day-to-day protection of the collection was giving them a purpose that was very helpful when you're starving to death, when you're in these very extreme circumstances, actually having a very simple thing to do each day gives your mind a clarity of purpose that I think was helpful for the botanists and perhaps even extended their lives. In fact, at least two of them say that that's true after the end of the war. So together they make the decision that, you know, we're not going to touch the collection. Ivanov says, you know, if we were to eat it, then after this war ends, as it will, people will judge us for that decision. And so, yes, together they decide to ignore the suggestion from the telegram and remain steadfast.
Mm. And one way in which you really help us appreciate that is not only in describing these events so vividly, but also in your very moving afterword, when at one point you say, "I have not known hunger, not properly. Like everyone else, I've been introduced on a school trip when I ate my packed lunch soon after the coach departed, leaving only crumbs to see me through to dusk, or on a long night drive when every fast food shop is closed a few hours earlier and chewing gum could only stretch so far, or at the cinema when I arrive too late for popcorn. Hunger, but glancingly, not close enough to shake its bony hand, then feel those fingers begin to rub the flesh away. How long might you or I survive if hunger arrived today?" It really helps put into perspective the valor of these staff members of the Plant Institute during the siege of Leningrad. And I think you do a magnificent job of telling this extraordinary story in your new book, The Forbidden Garden, The Botanists of Besieged Leningrad and Their Impossible Choice, published by Scribner. A book which includes some very interesting photographs to help enliven the story. Simon Parkin, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out the hour, we're going to spend a few minutes with someone that I'm sure many of you know, Curzio Caravatti. He is founder of Kufi Farm, And that stands for Kenosha Urban Farming Institute. And this is located in Summers. And it is designed to be a place where sustainable dry farming practices are studied and perfected. And under the auspices of Kufi Farm, there are all kinds of projects that have been underway, including the Kenosha Potato Project, the Kenosha Garlic Collection, One Vine Tomato, the Swiss Bee Chalet, and so on. And sometime over the next 2 weeks, you will be hearing a follow-up interview with Curzio Caravati, in which we will be talking about some of these projects which have given him such joy. But we want to spend a few minutes talking with him to finish out the program by talking about this whole notion of seed banks and why seed banks are created, why they are so important. And along the way, we will talk about Curzio Caravati's own participation in something called the U.S. Potato Gene Bank, which is something in some respects sort of comparable to what was talked about in Simon Parkin's book about the Plant Institute in Leningrad. And by the way, Curzio Caravati tells me that some years ago he had plans to visit St. Petersburg to see and visit the Plant Institute himself, but unfortunately something called COVID intervened and prevented that visit from occurring. So maybe someday he will be able to visit the Plant Institute, again mentioned in Simon Parkin's fascinating book, The Forbidden Garden. Anyway, we have Curzio Caravati in our studios for the next few minutes, and we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg, for inviting me. I guess that the 30 years that I spent in Kenosha at the very least produced this one thing that when you're talking seeds, people think of me. And I love that. And also, just a couple of things that you said that I need to correct immediately. The U.S. Gene Bank that we have in Wisconsin for potato seeds is now known as the International Gene Bank because it also includes Canada. And one more thing that I would like to mention right away in this interview is that my farm has changed names several times. So people may be confused. Many people know me because of garlic, because my first venture selling at the Kenosha public market, at the Kenosha markets. By the way, this is my 25th year as a vendor at the market. I started at Columbus Park. I was a founding member of Harbor Market. I was the manager of Harbor Market, and at one point the opportunity came to create a new market, and that's why I'm on the board of the Kenosha public market. But what I want to say is that my farm that started as Curzio Garlic and More eventually became Kufi Farm, and then I incorporated because I wanted my farm to be a non-profit, and I was able to pick the name KufiFarm.org, which is the same as the website. And that website launched yesterday, so people can just go KufiFarm.org and see all. And thank you, Jen Conrad. She did an incredible job. She's my director of communication, and she has done an incredible job creating this web page.
It's a beautiful website. I visited it myself, and there is a lot of information to be found there, and it is colorful and inviting to the eye. So very, very good.
So we have very few minutes here for this live interview, but really what I would like to get into is seeds. The concept of seed saving. Most people, when they think of seeds, they think about seed catalogs, and they already, actually, I already received seed catalogs for next year, 2025 catalogs already in the mail. And that's how we spend the winter as gardeners and farmers. We have these colorful catalogs, and we dream about the new season. You know, farmers are always dreaming of next year because there is always something that went wrong that can be perfected. So when you purchase seeds from a seed catalog, really you are looking at I'm thinking 0.1% of what's there. You know, in a seed catalog, maybe you have 20 varieties of tomatoes. There are 2 million varieties of tomatoes.
Hmm.
Really?
Hmm.
That many? How is it possible? Well, that is genetics. Because one gene, the change in the DNA of a plant, and the expression of that plant will be completely different. And then we get into epigenetics. You have genetical identity of two plants, but epigenetic will make a plant change. Even though the genetics don't change, the expression of the genes will change, and you're going to get a different plant.
Mm.
That's the one vine tomato. That's a tomato that has, well, the one vine tomato project at Kufi Farm, we are focusing on a tomato that has been grown in Kenosha for almost 100 years. We can trace it back to Sarnano, Italy, where in 1200, St. Francis d'Assisi lived for a couple of years. And we feel that the spirit of St. Francis is in this tomato. And we are going to have time to discuss the tomato another day. But really, what we need to focus on is how seeds is propagated. How do you keep the seed pure? And how do you save it? Like in St. Petersburg, they had all these drawers filled with envelopes, you know?
Envelopes?
Paper envelopes. Mm. Yeah. Marked with the names, mm-hmm. you know? And at times you have to deal with farmers who use these fat pencils to write down. I know that because they save potatoes into paper bags with their names written people always misread. Like Seneca Horn is one of our most precious potatoes in America because it was grown by the Seneca people in the border between New York and Canada. That's a heritage potato. But the farmer wrote Seneca and the N was misread as a W. That's how it became Seweka. And I discovered that potato genes in the gene bank at Seed Savers Exchange. And somehow my brain that thinks in six languages kind of clicked, oh my God, that's Seneca, that's not Seweka. And so we were able to find the people that collected the potato from the people of Seneca. And Seed Saver Exchange has it. So Seed Saver Exchange, by the way, is in Decorah, Iowa.
Right, Decorah, Iowa. That's a former hometown of mine.
Okay.
And so that would that be another example of a seed depository like the Plant Institute?
Correct.
Something
correct.
Like that.
Now, when I started years ago, I thought that in order to preserve this genetic diversity, you had to grow out the plants. And make sure that you had enough separation so that there would be no cross-pollination, you know. Mm. But with tubers, you don't have that because the tuber is actually cloned. And that is why Kufi Farm became a specialist in non-sexually propagated seed.
Mm.
Potatoes, garlic, and fruit trees are cloned. So that's how you keep a variety the same.
So you don't need to worry about that matter
yes,
then.
Yes, and I want to go into the evolution of seed banks. So seed banks that started like in St. Petersburg where they had this collection of potatoes, and that probably was the biggest plunder that they had to defend because, you know, when you have wheat seed, what do you do with that? Well, you have to grind it and make flour, but what are you going to do with 10 seeds? It's not going to even make enough to make nothing, right? But the potatoes, they were after that. That's what they were defending. And those potatoes that they were kept in the seed bank in St. Petersburg, with my knowledge that I have now, I know for a fact that those potatoes were not 100% healthy. Because that is one issue that we have with potatoes, that over time, as you keep saving the seed and replanting it, it gets contaminated by viruses. Mm. And now I don't want anybody to freak out here. Okay? When you buy potatoes at the grocery store, very likely you are buying a contaminated potato. Because viruses are very, very, very common. Mm. And they don't affect the nutritional value of the potato. They only affect how that potato can be replanted. So now we have developed ways of curing the plant, getting rid of the viruses. We then take a piece of the plant and put it in a vial with agar, and that is called in vitro. So we grow plants, potato plants, in vitro. They are in a vial. They are kept in a fridge with lights. And if you have a chance to ever visit a seed bank, that's what you're going to see. Hmm. A huge fridge filled of vials that have plants that grow with a very, very low rate. And every so often they have to clip that plant and put it in a new agar. That's how they keep it alive. And out of that plant, we make nuclear potato. So nuclear potato would be tubers that are grown from a plant that is 100% healthy. Hmm. And with that nuclear potato, seed companies made seed potatoes. Hmm. So, yes.
So explain the way in which something that I think a lot of Americans know something about, the Irish potato famine, how that raised an awareness of a real problem if you are focused on one or two varieties of potatoes.
In Ireland, there was a variety that is known as the lumper because it was like lumpy in shape. And that potato was extremely weak, you know. Now we have developed more and more potatoes that are stronger in resistance from the viruses. And suddenly, all of the potatoes grown in Ireland were the lumper. They had like a monocrop of one variety. That is the same as, imagine, if all of the orchards in Wisconsin would only grow
Granny Smith.
Honey Crisp. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everybody loves Honey Crisp. Imagine if all the orchards were Honey Crisp and something came in and would destroy all of these trees. We would lose the apple industry. And that is why the USDA... created the USDA was created to create a network that would keep all of these different plants in seed banks so that we could always go back to the original and perhaps in the original find the genes that can be now spliced and in a lab kind of build the perfect
So, for instance, this International Potato Gene Bank located near Sheboygan, of which you have been...
in Sturgeon Bay.
Sturgeon Bay. So how many varieties of potatoes are we talking about that are preserved there?
Thousands, maybe 5,000. And all of these 5,000 are wild potatoes. These are not the original potatoes. But one thing that I need to mention is Norway and Svalbard Global Seed Vault. So this is now the new seed bank of the world. What we had in St. Petersburg, now is in Norway. These potatoes are not part of the vault because potatoes need to be replanted every year. It's not something that you can just cryo freeze and keep it in the freezer.
Wow. And you tell me that nearly every country on Earth has something like that.
Right.
That's the largest, but every nation has these kind of seed vaults.
And in America, we have fridges filled with vials in so many places and universities that are studying potatoes, but those may not be available to the public. That is why it's very important to become a member of Seed Saver Exchange and follow kufifarm.org.
And we want to remind everybody again that website launched just yesterday, kufifarm.org. So that's KUFI, and it stands for Kenosha Urban Farming Institute, and its founder, Guzio Caravati. Guzio Caravati, thank you for your contribution to today's morning show. And we remind listeners that they'll be able to hear from you in the next couple of weeks in a follow-up longer interview. But thank you for this conversation today. Tomorrow on the morning show, Kaylin Palomares and her monthly visit to the program. And she will have with her a representative of the Wisconsin DNR. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be a partly cloudy day. We actually have the possibility of a shower a little bit later, and we're headed for a high today of 52 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.